Well, let's start. Good afternoon. So I'm hoping you're here and you know where you are. I'm clearly neither Peter Lilback nor Matt Whitling. So if you're looking for those people, you can go ahead and excuse yourself. I won't take it personally. But this is the workshop on capital campaigns. I'm Kyle Quill from the Covenant School of Dallas, the grammar of giving capital campaigns at classical Christian schools. You've obviously chosen to be here, which means you've chosen not to be present elsewhere, and I appreciate for your ill-informed decision. I do want your time to be valuable, and I hope that I might be able to share some things that are of encouragement to you. So three caveats up front. One, if you're in the world of development fundraising and you missed Harold Naylor's session this morning on biblical stewardship, I would highly recommend it. He gives a wonderful biblical overview of how we should approach the whole issue of raising funds through the lens of cultivating relationships for the spiritual good of potential donors. And so I highly recommend that. He really sets the stage. Secondly, I have made many mistakes in this realm, and so I'm speaking very much to myself this afternoon. And then thirdly, I am no fundraising professional. I am a head of school who started out as a development director. I am no fundraising professional. So be sure and consult your attorney, your accountant, and or your medical professional before taking any of my counsel to heart. Okay, so with that, time is of the essence, and there's a lot of ground to cover. My style is a bit on the cheesy, goofy side, high-octane side, so forgive me if I'm overly enthusiastic, but it is Friday afternoon, for goodness sake, and if you're like me, at least if I were in your seat right now, I'd be on the verge of falling asleep, and so I'm going to do everything I can, if not to inform and inspire you, to at least keep you awake. So that's my goal, among other things. So I'm going to cut right to the chase. Here's my objective. My objective is to sketch out and discuss the steps, structures, and strategies to launch, hopefully, a successful capital campaign within the context of presumably your school, a classical Christian school. Introduction. The need for conversion. We live in times which can make fundraising for Christians difficult. The economics issue aside, I'm talking mostly about the theological climate. On one hand, we have the health and wealth gospel of our own homegrown Texas megastar, Joel Osteen, where financial success is seen not as the result necessarily of hard work, industry, and the creation of value, but by merely claiming it into existence, your best life now. Interestingly enough, despite what you might think about such a theological framework, which I would suspect most of us have serious issues with, the megachurch millionaire, Osteen, is quite the embodiment of a very clever, creative, and highly successful entrepreneur. Of course, this whole approach can be aided and abetted by Christians for whom the pursuit of money has become the idol of choice. That's on one hand. On the other hand, though, take what seems to often be a kind of anti-capitalist bias in mainstream media, and often in many Christian circles, who embrace a kind of guilt complex when it comes to the issue of money. From this view, often motivated perhaps out of legitimate concern for the poor, the view is that money is deemed as evil, perhaps, and making money through business is merely a neutral or, at worst, a secular endeavor. This thinking is the common bedfellow to a kind of dualism that drives a Cartesian wedge between the material and the immaterial, reducing God's concern to the immaterial. And interestingly, there's kind of a parallel view which often tends to reduce that which is spiritual to the immaterial. We'll see, I think, not a biblical notion at all. As such, with this kind of dualistic mentality, which has a bearing upon the world of fundraising and capital campaign cultivation, I would argue, with this kind of view, the spirit trumps the body. And having a quiet time trumps mowing the lawn. I'll never forget about 20 years ago, I spent the summer, this was when I was still a bachelor, over in England and Wales, and I spent part of my summer at La Brie in Greenwich, England, with Susan and Ronald McCauley, Susan Schaefer McCauley. And one evening after a meal, I was in the kitchen with Susan Schaefer McCauley, and we were cleaning up, and somehow we got to talking about marriage, and I was struck by a comment she made about marriage. She said, when it comes down to it, marriage is about dirty dishes and dirty diapers. Now, some 17 years of marriage later and three children, I tend to actually agree with that. I think there's a lot more to marriage, and if you're married, you hopefully agree with me. But it is interesting to see what I think her point was. It's not that we honor God through the mundane. If God is God, there is no such realm as the mundane. All is sacred, including dirty dishes, dirty diapers, and even money. And incidentally, if you have any dirty money, I'd suggest that you launder it. So dualism is false and thus detrimental not only for successfully launching a capital campaign at a classical Christian school, but for all of life. Dualism conveniently renders money and material reality outside the realm of Christ's primary jurisdiction. And let's face it, that's a very handy position to take when we want to reject Christ's lordship over all of life, so as to rationalize whatever we want to do with things like our bodies, our stuff, and our money. So as we talk about capital campaigns at classical Christian schools, I think we as Christians face a need for conversion, a need for repentance, a need for metanoia, 180-degree turning of our thinking and living. So that as we do, I think we'll see that if what we claim as Christians is true, then we actually have and possess the best resources available to support in theory and practice the most robust justification for making, raising, and using God's money for God-honoring purposes. Let me say that again if I could. My conviction is this, that if what we say as Christians is true, if Christ, in fact, is Lord of all, then we possess, more than anyone, the best resources in theory and practice for making a robust justification for the making, raising, and using of God's money for God-honoring purposes. Quickly, in my extended introduction, the encouragement of cattle. Now, we've often heard it said, and it's true. It's in Scripture. It's Psalm 50, verse 10, in case you don't know the reference, that God owns the cattle on 1,000 hills. Well, guess what else God owns? He also owns the hills. We don't have time to unpack a full biblical theology of stewardship. And since Mr. Naylor is now with us, I put a plug in for you earlier. So do listen to him in his session from this morning if you missed it, to get a wonderful overview of biblical stewardship. But I think it's critical we briefly lay a foundation. Many of these themes we've touched on and heard from throughout various speakers over the last couple of days. Creation, Genesis 1:1, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth, all that is seen and unseen. He declared it all good and very good. The incarnation, in the beginning, John 1, was the Word, and the Word was God, and the Word was with God. And the Word became flesh, physical, bodily, meaty. The Word became flesh. Do you really believe it? And dwelt among us. And we beheld his glory, glory as of the only begotten from the Father, full of grace and truth. Redemption, Romans 8. The creation itself also will be set free from its slavery to corruption into the freedom of the glory of the children of God. Now, I don't know if we have any logic teachers in our midst. Anybody in here teach logic? Okay, good. Good. I'm not sure if this is an airtight syllogism, but consider this. If God is the original source and ultimate end of all good things, if God has created all things and declared them good, very good, if everything that everyone has, our bodies, our brains, and yea, lo, verily, our bank accounts are from God and are to be used for God, if matter really matters, if God has blessed us with all the gifts that we have and expects us to steward them so as to experience his joy, to feel his pleasure for our good and for his glory. Ergo, number one, it's good to ask people for God's money to be used for God's purposes. Ergo, number two, I don't know if you can actually have two ergos, but nevertheless, failure to do so can actually rob people of the joy that is otherwise theirs. Just think about that for a second. Failure to ask people to invest their money in God's purposes, their money, which is really God's money on loan to them, for God's purposes, potentially robs them of the joy that is theirs from God in doing so. Do you really want to be that person who's robbed somebody else from God's joy? I didn't think so. What's magical to me about the incarnation, and yes, magical, is that in Christ, the Creator has united himself to his creation in a person for all eternity. That is radical if we really meditate on it, isn't it? If you're like me, I find myself too often not thinking deeply on the profound fundamental truths of Christianity. The incarnation should blow us away. The ontological reality of the incarnation is staggering. It's, as C.S. Lewis has said, the myth that has become fact. Well, what does the incarnation have to do with capital campaigns? Everything. Christ has come for the life of the world. He's about the business of redeeming everything that he has created. Personal, corporate, cultural, and cosmic restoration. He will not stop till he's complete. The resurrected and ascended Christ has all authority on heaven and earth. In the well-known words of Dutch Prime Minister theologian Abraham Kuyper, you've heard him before, let me say him again. There's no square inch of all of life over which Jesus Christ, sovereign of all, does not place his banner and claim, mine. That includes our money. So if we're honest, for many of us, asking people for money is about as scary as speaking in public. But if by faith we really see our resurrected Lord on his throne, and if we really believe that we're asking people for purposes that are about Christ's kingdom and his glory, then why are we afraid? I love this quote from Henry Nouwen from a little booklet I'd highly recommend. Nouwen might not have floated in the same theological circles that many of us float in, but boy, there's a lot that is true, good, and beautiful, in my humble opinion, in his writings. This is a little booklet called The Spirituality Fundraising. Here's what he says. Are we willing to be converted from our fear of asking, our anxiety about being rejected or feeling humiliated, our depression when someone says, no, I'm not going to get involved in your project? Are we willing to be converted from our fear? Accepted by God in Christ, we are, aren't we? We're free. We should be, if the gospel's true, and we really believe it, free from the fear of rejection. We've been accepted by the only one who ultimately matters. Who cares what man does to me? So whatever we need to raise, maybe it's $5, maybe it's $50, maybe it's $50,000, maybe it's $50 million. The cattle on a thousand hills should encourage us, should literally fill us with courage when it comes to fundraising, even in the face of failure and rejection. You know, I heard recently someone make this comment about the wonderful parable of the stewards, the three servants who are given talents as their master goes away. Of course, we know what happens. One's given 10 and duplicates it. One's given 5, duplicates it. The other's given 1 and buries it. He doesn't know the master. In fact, he has a very bad theology. And he's actually misrepresented the master and stolen from the master. He could have at least earned interest, but he doesn't even do that. And of course, he gets what's coming to him. The person made this comment that I heard talking about this parable recently, said, I wish that Jesus had included someone who had buried or had actually invested the talent, but lost, failed. But I think we know what the master would say to the one who tried to invest and failed. Enter into the joy of your master. Why fear to fail? As Christians, we should be filled with courage. We have a wonderfully compelling story that should turn us from a posture of fear and propel us into a position of faith and freedom when it comes to capital campaigns. Finally, by word of my long-winded introduction, the reality of culture change. Just a brief comment here. Cultures change neither overnight nor easily. As James Hunter has noted in his book, To Change the World, significant culture change is slow-going and tends to flow from the top down within centers of influence. It's no different when it comes to our schools and to creating a healthy culture of fundraising in them. It's got to be modeled, in my opinion, with great patience over a long period of time by the board and administration. To that end, school leadership would be wise to make financial and facilities decisions that their great-grandchildren, where their great-grandchildren are kept in mind. This is how great institutions are established and made sustainable. A couple of years ago, a highly selective all-boys college prep school here in Dallas had a centennial celebration. They were celebrating their first 100 years. And that's what they had on their banner. The first 100 years. The first 100 years. Shouldn't Christian schools humbly have that kind of confident hope as we look to the future? Of all educational institutions, classical Christian schools should not merely be about surviving, but truly thriving, both now and for the long term. Now, eschatological nuances aside, pre, post, pan, let's begin with the end in mind. And just consider with me the possibility that the body of Christ in history may only be but a toddler. Okay, so now, what I'd like to do is consider a few critical factors involved with these things in mind in establishing a solid foundation for launching a successful capital campaign at your school. The three sources of revenue. Now, as private schools, our institutions obviously do not enjoy the tax base shared by our public school counterparts. As mostly independent schools, not affiliated with a particular church or denomination, our institutions do not enjoy the tithe base shared by our parish-affiliated counterparts. So we neither enjoy the tax nor tithe support that many other schools have. And apart from endowments and earnings from investments, three core sources of revenue I would propose exist for our schools. Tuition revenue, which, as an aside, if your school is not making an effort to move to cost-based tuition, where at least 95 to 100% of your operational costs are covered by your tuition revenue, I would strongly encourage you to do so incrementally and wisely, but purposely as soon as you can. Otherwise, you're giving discounts to all of your parents, many of whom do not need them, and in turn, develop a financial aid program to help those that need it. Two, annual gifts, ongoing solicitation of gifts for scholarships, programmatic enhancements, et cetera. Again, Harold's comments this morning in his session were so helpful in my thinking about trying to cultivate a more Christ-centered biblical approach to fundraising in an annual, ongoing way within the cultures of our school. It's really I know you said you weren't a pastor, but it really is kind of a pastoral ministry to come alongside, not just hit people up for money, but to really ask where their hearts are, what's going on in their lives, how they might feel called to participate in life of your school, and to do that over time. Third, though, the third source of revenue, tuition, annual gifts, capital campaign gifts. So that you're in this workshop communicates to me that your school is either thinking about planning a capital campaign or maybe in the middle one, or you may be lost and think I'm Matt Whitley, which I'm not. So with that, I want to ask just a few questions. How many of you are in the midst of a capital campaign right now? Anybody? Anybody's schools in the midst of a capital campaign? Okay, excellent. How many of your schools have completed one in the past 12 to 18 months? Okay. How many of you are considering launching one in the future, say in the next 6, 12, 24 months? Okay, excellent. Very good. The reason schools have capital campaigns is that schools that stick around are not merely exciting startup organizations organized around a charismatic leader or group of devoted pioneering families. They're about the business of maturing into sustainable institutions that far exceed the life of any founding chapter of Pioneers or any particular charismatic headmaster or development director. The school is institution. Now, how many of your schools, a few more questions here, how many of your schools currently lease the facilities that you use? Show of hands. Okay. How many of your schools own land and are looking to build a campus? Okay. How many of your schools have your own property and campus but are looking to go to the next level? Perhaps you're in portables, temporaries, and you're wanting to go to bricks and mortar. Okay, so we've got a pretty good mix here. And keep in mind, I recognize there are probably many people in here who have a lot more experience about these things. So what I'm hoping at the end, if I can plow through my materials, we'll have some time for Q&A so we can learn from each other. So the school is institution. There's a natural trajectory here, isn't there, for a school's maturation as it evolves from the mom and pop founders stage into becoming an established institution. From inception to institution, you start out leasing, you eventually buy some land. Now, maybe you buy land that already has a structure on it, or maybe I think with Logos up in Moscow, they bought what I think was originally a skating rink and converted it into a school. But let's just say you buy land, and then you eventually raise money to put portables on the land, and then you eventually add some bricks and mortar, and then you have a combination of portables, bricks, and mortar, and then eventually, maybe 100 years from now, we're all bricks and mortar. But there's a kind of natural trajectory of the evolution and maturation of a startup from inception to institutionalization. It's natural. It's good. It's healthy. It's all about the development from seed form to fully developed, as it were, oak tree. There's an organic logic here that just makes sense. It's only as a school moves from the startup phase to owning its own property and planting its own roots in its own soil that it sets itself up for the long term. Until the school is there, it's still inevitably in a kind of experimental state of flux. Will it make it? Is it viable? Is there really buy-in? Does the market demand its mission or not? Properties and facilities mean permanence. And every school's timeline to reach these benchmarks will vary. I humbly believe, as I think you all do, that God is always faithful and timely. And the reality is, even with that, no two schools have the same story as to his provisions. And that's part of our own story to tell. Some schools might start up with the gift of an existing 40 acres of land with permanent structures. I was talking earlier with, is it Sue? Pardon me, Sue Head, not to put you on the spot, from Ozarka Christian School in Arkansas. Oh, you got it wrong on both counts. Yeah, that person there from that school somewhere out of Texas. Thank you very much. So they're starting a school at a college. Wow. They've got land. They've got facilities. They just need kids and teachers and administrators. Everybody's startup is a little different. Some schools might have that kind of setup. Other schools may wander for many years through the wilderness of leasing space at churches and synagogues, as has been our school's experience here in Dallas at the Covenant School. where we existed and grew for the first 15 years before moving on to our own campus just about 5 years ago. In fact, we'll have existed for nearly 20 years before opening our first permanent bricks and mortar structure with a multi-purpose gym and academic wing, Lord willing, this fall. 20 years for us before we had a bricks and mortar structure. Now, some people have asked me, now, when will your campus be complete? Well, what I typically say, it's only a matter of time and money, and would you like to write a big check today? And it's fascinating. People ask that question, maybe this is your experience, typically are not in a position to give you a big check on the spot. They just want to know, what's the plan? We'll come to that. I know of a Christian high school in L.A. There was a Christian, evangelical Christian school that went up to eighth grade. There were some grandparents of kids going through that school that didn't have a Christian school option for high school. So what did these grandparents do? They gave stock options to a startup effort in the equivalent of somewhere in the range of $25 to $30 million to begin what is a extremely successful, high-tech, cutting-edge Christian college prep school in L.A. that's busting at the seams and has a lot of bells and whistles that colleges don't have. Wow. That's a helpful way to start out to say for sure. Now, short of an unexpected windfall, the fact is that our school will likely be in some kind of building or capital campaign mode for the next 15 to 20 to 30 to 40 years. And I suspect that many of your schools are in the same boat. Question, what drives the plan as you move forward? Well, the master plan. The master plan. Of course, through prayer, scripture, the wisdom of many counselors, and sanctified common sense, we'd hope that our master plan is the master's plan for our school. At least that's, of course, the hope. So moving into the chapter of owning land for our future permanent campuses, our schools desperately need to establish and regularly update master's facility plans. Plan the work and work the plan. Now hear this, without an informed mapping out of your campus, driven by things like enrollment, desired student-teacher ratios, class sections, your architectural vision, your academic needs, your co-curricular programs in athletics, in art, in drama, you'll struggle to take the first step towards launching a successful capital campaign with any semblance of strategy and likely success. Now, the master plan is something every school goes through. This is an example of a version of the master plan for our current school, the Covenant School here in Dallas. Long story short is we purchased about 6-7 years ago, just shy of 18 acres in the heart of North Dallas, just off LBJ and Central. Unfortunately, about 3.5 there on the left side by the pond are in a floodplain, and they're not buildable unless we spent a ton of money to reclaim some of that. So we're limited to about 13.5 acres. So we knew going in that we had to kind of plan for every square inch of that space to maximize it in a way that made sense and that enabled us to grow out the campus without shutting our operational life down. So it's a trick to pull that off, but the top half for us is what we call our academic village. I don't know if any of you were on our campus last night for the dinner, but you saw what's in essence the top half. And those are portable temporary buildings that were built on site. We couldn't afford, and I'll get to this in a bit, but we couldn't afford to build bricks and mortar coming out of the gate. So we put the portable temporary buildings to get our school K-12 on the same property. The bottom half of those big buildings north of the football field and track are permanent structures. Now, if you look at number 10, if you can see that, that's a multi-purpose gymnasium. We're on the verge of completing that. That's the kind of the anchor permanent structure for us, the first one with an academic wing. But this kind of shows where we could head, at least in a kind of middle plan as we move forward. But the plan is critical to inform your priority. Now, over a decade ago, our school launched a capital campaign called From the Heart for the Future. Now, what's interesting about that is that was done when we were leasing space at a church and synagogue to raise money for future capital projects, the growth of our logic rhetoric school, and our financial aid program. Some 5 years later, we had a town hall meeting with our parents and asked them what they preferred and what they were really interested in doing as we looked at the next step. And we laid out various scenarios with price tags and options, everywhere from permanent structures, classrooms and a gym, to portables. Well, it was very interesting. The priority from the community was clear. We needed to get the two divisions of our school, then leasing at this church and synagogue, on our own campus in nicely constructed, painted, landscaped, and affordable classrooms. This feedback was very strategic and helpful in informing our school board's decision-making and risk assessment process. With $5 million raised towards the purchase of that 18 acres, we launched another capital campaign called Forward in Faith. I came on right as that happened as the development director right before that. It's a very exciting time. We're in the process of buying the land and on ground zero of trying to put together a plan for a capital campaign. And we raised another $5 million towards the construction of what we call our academic village, that top half of that master plan. So 2+ years ago, we began yet another capital campaign the Building Lifetime Learners Capital Campaign, to raise roughly another $6 million to build the building I've described to you, our first permanent bricks and mortar structure. That building is scheduled to open this fall. Meanwhile, we're not even done with that building. We're planning now. We're planning even now for the next phase as to priorities. What's needed next? Community space? Additional classrooms? Both? How are we going to fund it? What are our priorities? What are your school's priorities? Could you tell me if I ask you, if you had to raise your hand and tell everybody, what are your school's priorities right here, right now, that would inform what a capital campaign would seek to raise and why? It's all part of the story you've got to tell in raising funds. Perhaps it's property. Perhaps it's classrooms. Perhaps it's a gym. It's a cafeteria, chapel, playgrounds, parking lot expansion. Who knows what it may be? The point here is simple. You must determine what your school's capital priorities are in order to have a capital campaign. It seems simple enough, doesn't it? How many schools perhaps don't have actually a strategically informed master plan that inform why they have capital campaigns and when? You should be committed to a continual process of assessing and revising these same plans. If you do not have a clear vision of your school's future, including its facilities future, I would propose you're not in a position to launch a capital campaign. It's just that simple. In fact, I would suggest that to do so could actually be fatal to your organization. Why? Well, to pursue money without a clearly articulated vision for your school's future could hijack your school's mission with the sheer pursuit of money. As a side note, quite frankly, I can't imagine most donors of any significant capacity are going to be propelled and compelled to give much of anything to a school that doesn't have a story to tell. It's only as our schools pursue our God-honoring missions that money is put in its properly subservient role as a means to that greater end. Without that in place, money becomes the mission. And this is what leads to the secular, slippery slope of secularism for so many Christian organizations. At least it's one of the main causes, in my humble opinion. That's no place any of us want to be. With a clear mission and vision, your school, however, is ready to determine its priorities and how best realistically to stage future campaigns to provide for that financial need. Notice, and this is an important vocab distinction, I use the word need. As we'll see, the need itself you think you may have may not necessarily become, or should not necessarily become, the publicly stated goal for your capital campaign. So how does all this fit together? We've looked at the grammar, as it were. How does this fit together? Well, it's time to graduate now to the logic school of Capital Campaign 101. The strategy. So your school's serious about the investment needed to solidify its position as a permanent institution. You've worked out a master's facilities plan and determined your priorities. Let's say, for the sake of this example, that you conclude that you need to raise $10 million to buy some land and build some classrooms. So that'll be our kind of working example. $10 million is your target, or so it seems. How do you get from where you are to there, from the proverbial point A to point B? Now, at this point, you may want to consider doing something. Administrators, come alongside your board. Do we have any board members here? Often schools at this point of the discussion might realize, okay, we're at a kind of a crossroads here. Can we do this internally? Are we staffed up internally? Our director of advancement, who's over admissions and development, Shea Gasway, is back there. We're very blessed to have a full-time person. She's got a lot on her plate, both with development and admissions. But we, in our school, feel like with the right person, with the gifts that Shea has, she pulls it off and does it well. Do you have the staff needed to support internally a capital campaign? Even if you do, do you need to consider outside help? Many times schools right at this point consider a kind of cost-benefit analysis in terms of bringing in the big guns. Over the years, I've actually spoken to a good number of schools, many ACCS schools, who've contacted us asking about our opinion about consulting groups that we've worked with. Now, I am not here to give a plug for any particular outfit in terms of consulting groups. I'd be happy to talk to you in much more depth offline about any of our experiences. But the point is this. We have used consultants in different capacities during the last two campaigns. For our Forward in Faith campaign, we used a group called Paideia to help us with a readiness or feasibility study. We'll come to that in just a minute. For our Building Lifetime Learners campaign, we used, during the planning and quiet phases, a group called MAP, Mission Advancement Partners. What I'll say is that there's always a significant cost to consider. There's a potential cost to consider that's very hard to calculate as to what happens if you don't use outside consulting work and support. But then there's a very real cost to consider of what it's going to cost to use consultants, which, last I checked, aren't very cheap. So bringing in consultants can provide helpful leverage and insight from the sanctified common sense of fundraising best practices. If all truth is God's truth, and there exist principles in life I know this may be a novel thought for some, but if there are principles in life that reflect the way simply things are, even if they're not tied to a particular chapter and verse, then there can be great value in having outside authorities remind us, school leaders, who may be tempted to think that our schools are special exceptions to reality. In my humble opinion, there's a double-decker highway that leads to hell. There's one level that goes right to hell. The other level leads to failed capital campaigns, and both levels are paved with very good intentions often. My point is that we need all the help we can get, and if you can afford it, I'd recommend getting it. The study. What is the study? The second step in the logic of a capital campaign. So you've got to kind of strategize how this is going to play out. You've got to consider doing a study. You've got to do a study in one way or another. You may have determined the need, but what you need to determine now is this, as best you can, the potential range of actual support, not pie in the sky kind of support, but actual support that may exist within the concentric circles of your own constituents. Fundraising, as I think you all well know, is both an art and a science, and no one can say exactly how things will play out for your school, all under the inscrutable providence of God and his unpredictable provision. We all know this. But that said, the case is simple, and the facts are what they are. For most schools like ours and for most nonprofits in general, typically 80 to 85% of your donations will come from those most intimately and immediately invested in your school community. The board, parents, staff, alum, if you have them, and grandparents. The remaining 15 to 20% may come from foundations and corporations. Now listen, I'm all for having a confident Christ-centered hope as we plan for the future. And I don't want any of your schools to leave money on the table when it comes to raising it. But in the spirit of Christian realism, I would exhort you all to consider realistically not to expect more than 10% of your campaign coming from foundations. And if anything, less than 5% from corporations. As we well know, over the past many years, especially in a down economy, foundations and corporations have been overwhelmed by well-meaning missional organizations seeking for help. The key is to differentiate your school from the others. The real trick is to have a personal connection to someone with a foundation who could move your grant application from the big stack to the small stack. Now, we could spend time talking about how to coordinate your own school's mission in such a way that aligns with a foundation's particular mission. You all know this, I think. You can do all sorts of research as to what foundations give to, where they've given historically, what their particular areas of interest are. You do not want to fabricate or compromise or water down the integrity of your own school's mission, but there are creative and truthful ways to present your school and its mission in a way that might align in all integrity and honesty with the foundation more effectively than other presentations. So those are just things to consider. And let's also just consider this fact, and we've experienced this at Covenant. Boy, all sorts of things can happen to kind of hurt your efforts in the fundraising world. You might remember, I hate to even say this on tape, but we're that little school that beat the other school in basketball a few years ago, 100-0. I'm sorry. No, I shouldn't even apologize. We're on to winning, but that whole mess was a tough one. We got our phone system shut down because we were inundated by hate calls and emails, and we had to take my own personal phone line at home off the records. It was a mess. Right, reporters breaking into our campus. We found out later that the fact that we won that game and the whole mess erupted as it did cost us hundreds of thousands of dollars from foundations and donors. It's tough. That's the way sometimes it works. And let's face it, there are many also challenges for those schools that are distinctly and robustly Christian. That doesn't always pay off in this world, does it? Especially for those foundations that, by policy, do not support sectarian organizations. Reminds me of Gomer Pyle. Surprise, surprise, surprise. We should not be surprised. The other fact to consider is this. Foundations must be courted. If you're on the verge of starting your first capital campaign and you discover there's a foundation that gives to classical Christian schools in your neighborhood, I'd expect a gift from them if handled properly, maybe the next 2 to 3 years. It's highly unlikely, unless you just have an amazing connection, that you're going to get any money from that foundation anytime soon. They have to be courted. They have to be wooed. You have to earn their affection. And this may take 2 to 3 years before the relationship proves to be fruitful for the first time. So this step of the capital campaign planning process is what I'm calling the study. It's often called the readiness or feasibility study. I'm going to spend more time on this little section than anywhere else, so just bear with me, because I think it's critical personally for a successful capital campaign. Through it, you'll basically do this. You'll go digging for gold, you or your help, your consultants, to decipher with discretion what I would call the financial topography of your support base. We've done it in two ways. We've scheduled sit-down interviews between consultants and, say, 50 sets of parents. And this gave the consultants a chance, a third party to come in, and a chance to ask these people confidentially. These people, knowing that their names would not be affiliated or associated or connected with any of the comments that they give these consultants, to ask them confidentially all sorts of things about the school. So it's a chance to have some good, honest feedback, kind of a survey, in-person survey. But then also embedded in that process for the consultants to ask those same people, not an ask for a gift on the spot, but a kind of hypothetical ask. If we were to do Project X, Y, and Z on this scale of $10 million to $5,000, where might your potential hypothetical gift fall? And from this kind of information, all sorts of feedback is given as to the lay of the land when it comes to the financial topography of your particular community. The end product of this kind of approach is a document that provides, again, confidentially, both general feedback as well as specific feedback gleaned from those interviewed. And what should come out of that is a kind of range of potential support. Potential. When we did this with a group 5, 6, 7 years ago, we were a bit baffled because there were about $2 to $3 million that we could never find. And as a side note, we actually think there was some confusion in some of the communication with the consultants and some of the potential donors who had actually participated in the land purchase, but hadn't paid off their pledge. Side note to a side note, be very careful about the timing of your capital campaigns and the timing of how your donors pay out their pledges. Not that there's any malicious intent for most of our donors, but sometimes it can just get awfully confusing. If you go to a donor when they're in their third year of paying off a four-year pledge and you ask them for a new pledge for a new project, and they say, sure. In their mind, they might think they have $200,000 left to pay off their pledge, and they've given you a $400,000 pledge for a new project, and you're thinking that's $400,000 in addition to the $200,000 that they owe. And they're thinking that's just $200,000 more on top of the $2,000 I've yet to pay. Does that make sense? It just gets real confusing if you're not real clear. And perhaps I wasn't just then. Another version as to this study is to provide consultants a list of those within your school community who are in the know. You know who these people are. Some of you may be them. Call them mavens, parking lot mafia. Call them what you will. You know who they are. This can be a wonderful resource at a time like this. In this approach, consultants sit down one-on-one with people, the insiders, again, all confidentially. And they go down a list of names to find out whose business just sold for $20 million. Who's on the brink of divorce? Who's having to sell their lake house? Whose father just died and left them a windfall? Now, I realize you're sitting there and some of you are feeling a bit squirmish. This may be making some of you feel, in fact, a bit dirty right now. You may be thinking, you know, if this isn't immoral, it just seems creepy. Maybe even unbiblical. I don't know why, but it just seems wrong. It may sound like, you know, what an ambulance-chasing lawyer would do. My loving counsel to you is this. Get over it. If you're going to be strategic about raising real dollars for your school, assuming that your school's mission warrants such support, you've got to do two things. You've got to find out who has both the buy-in and the capacity to close in proximity close to your school. And then two, you've got to establish a plan then to cultivate those people in an appropriate, personal, Christ-honoring way in time and over time. Jesus commands us to be wise as serpents and innocent as doves, and it applies to the art and science of fundraising. Okay, one more comment before I show you what I think is a helpful graph. When it comes to this study, don't forget the so-called Pareto's principle. You know this. Maybe you don't know it by that name. The 80-20 rule, now often just called the 90-10 rule. It's the law that the vital few, basically, it's the law that the vital, that says basically that a majority of effects in most situations come from a minority of causes. Let me say that again. It's the law of the vital few that says that a majority of effects in most situations come from a minority of causes. Now think about it with me. You know this. Whether we're discussing the volunteer base of parents at your school who tend to help with morning carpool, hot lunches, setting up for grandparents' day, or whatever it may be, to your most significant capital campaign donors. This is simply a reflection of the way things tend to work, aka reality. We can hope and pray and wish things were different, but again, working within the realm of reality can be a helpful first step on the path to success. So what is this Pareto's principle have to do with respect to our hypothetical $10 million capital campaign? Let me put it bluntly. It means that 10% of your likely donor base will provide 90% of your need. Let me just say that again. In any of your campaign, 10% of your likely donor base will likely provide 90% of your need. In this case, $9 million of your campaign. Now, look, I'm all for things like 100% board and staff participation. We were blessed to have that in our most recent Building Lifetime Learners campaign. That's great. Foundations in particular like that data point. They want to see that those most invested support the project. I'm also for a community-wide vote, as it were, a kind of mandate from the school community that they're behind this. This isn't just being kind of pushed down from on high. This is something that reflects the will and the spirit and the heart of your parents and your tuition payers. But let's face it, there is a place for $50, $100, and $500 gifts. And there may be a place for fourth grade garage sales and second grade bake sales. Though, if you've not read it, I would highly recommend Bruce Lockerbie's book, From Candy Sales to Committed Donors, to set you straight. If you have any kind of wrapping paper sales-oriented fundraising efforts and or chocolate candy type things or any kind of product-driven efforts in general, just abolish them now. Just get rid of them. I would highly encourage you to do so. Focus your time and energy and sweat equity on cultivating relationships with real people over time. There may be a place for these things. There may not be. And listen to this, please, especially in light of what Harold said so well and so from his heart earlier today. And I agree with everything he said. God may very well be more pleased. Please hear this if you've not heard anything else I've said. He very well may be more pleased, probably is, with the sacrificial proceeds of a child's lemonade stand given in faith than he is with the $500,000 gift from a narcissistic philanthropist. That's the kind of God we have. That's pretty cool. God loves the widow's mite more, perhaps, than the oil tycoon's millions. But guess what? Capital campaigns are not built with nickels, dimes, and widow's mites. They're just not. It takes pyramids to build buildings, and it takes wealthy people to build pyramids. Whether we like it or not, there is an inescapable hierarchy to reality. So check this out. As an example, how to raise $10 million. Now, this is a crazy example, but I just want to make a point. Well, you could find 20,000 people to give $100 gifts, 4,000 to give $500, 2,000 to give $1,000, 800 to give $2,500 gifts, and 200 people to give $10,000 gifts. That equals only 27,000 donors to cultivate and manage and send a lot of thank you notes to. Or you could find one person to give $2 million, two people to each give $1 million, four people to give $500,000, eight people to give $250,000, and 40 to give $50,000. Now, the baseline is particularly unrealistic. You're not going to find probably that many. The bottom half or the bottom slot would be, you know, all sorts of gifts. But this would give you $10 million with 55 donors. Now, even if you triple it to 175, what would that be? 65? Thank you. 165? Thank you. It's good to have colleagues here with you, right? Which is more manageable? What's the best way to raise $10 million? With 27,000 donors or 55 or 155 donors? Well, you know, with limited staff and limited time and limited energy, it makes sense to focus on those with capacity and to cultivate them over time. It's not to say there's not a place for the widow's mite. It's not to say there's not a place for the lemonade stand proceeds. But if you're going to build real buildings and really become an institution, be serious about capital campaigns, you've got to honestly face the fact that you've got to get big gifts. Now, your pyramid may be a lot more modest. Your goal may be $1 million. And the top of your pyramid may be a $50,000 gift or $100,000 or $500,000. Somebody's got to be at the top. It's not that you put a plaque in their name on the front door of your school. But you got to know who they are. You've got to have a good idea. And you've got to approach them with strategy and with confidentiality. Now, one last word about consultants before we go into the structure, and I've got to pick it up here in the time I have left. One of the potential benefits employing outside consultants for this stage is to bring in these neutral parties to give some input. The challenge is this. I'm just going to be honest with you here. I've tried to be honest up to this point for the most part. No, I've been on. Let's face it. Put yourself in the consultant's shoes. The consultants come in to do this study to determine how much they think can be raised in a capital campaign realistically, right? And then they give this report back to the school. Well, there's a kind of conflict of interest here, it seems to me. They can provide much help, counsel, needed leverage, but it's also to their advantage to take a more aggressive stance as to the projected amounts that could be raised in your school, as based on the study. Why is that? Well, the larger the amount projected to be realistic for a particular campaign, the easier it may be for your school to justify keeping them on board, to use them during the duration of the campaign. Case in point, a $10 million campaign. It may not be uncommon to think, and legitimately, that 3 to 5% of that could be used for fundraising purposes, right? For brochures, for videos, for postcards, for dinners, and for consulting fees, which easily of $500,000 could make up $350,000. They're expensive. So it's in their best interest to kind of inflate the projected amount that they think could be raised within your community. Just keep that in mind. They don't like people to say that kind of thing publicly, probably, but there it is. Once done, your readiness or feasibility study should be used to modify your initial financial need as based on your facilities planning and priorities to reach a goal for your capital campaign. Notice, again, the difference between need and goal. Critical difference. You may have had a $10 million need only to realize there's at best $5 million to raise within your donor base. The study does indicate, after all, how ready, the readiness study, your community is to support your campaign. It shows how feasible, feasibility study, how feasible success is for your campaign. The study helps transform and edit and modify your need to a realistic goal. It's very important to make a distinction between those two numbers. The structure, quickly. When it comes to the structure of your campaign, there are many ways to skin the cat. However you do it, it's imperative that the lines of responsibility and authority are clear and clearly delineated between your school board, the development committee, the head of school, development director, and campaign leadership. Now, this is just one example. It's an incomplete kind of model as to what you could do. Now, I didn't quite know how to add all the lines, but really you've got the board of directors, you've got the head of school, the director of development reports, in our case, director of advancement, Mrs. Gassaway, to me. Now, she's on the development committee, which is a board-appointed standing committee. She, as well as me, we're both on the capital campaign committee, which really should be a subservient committee to the development committee. And then you have all these other roles on that committee cabinet. You have your chair or co-chair. You have your major gifts person. You may have a facility liaison from the staff. You have a communications person. All these people somehow need to be tied together with clearly delineated realms and areas of responsibility under the authority, ultimately, of the board, working in conjunction with your administration. Now, you've heard the saying, what's smoke in the pulpit is fog in the pews. If your organizational chart and realms of responsibility are unclear or fuzzy before a capital campaign, just wait. Just wait till you get into the mix and the quagmire that can be a capital campaign as to who's on first and who does what. Let me throw this out as well in terms of the timeline. Now, this is an example of a very aggressive timeline. You might be asking, okay, how long does it take to pull all this off if you kind of followed the logic and the case I'm trying to make here? This is why I think schools can't do capital campaigns, really shouldn't do, but every 5 to 6 years if you're going to have a full-fledged capital campaign. Here's why. Let's say this is aggressive. This is, I think, unrealistic, to be honest, if you're starting from scratch. Discussion prayer, let's say 6 months devoted to that. Okay, is the Lord calling us to do this? Do we have an agreement as to the direction we're headed? Let's take 3 months to really try to figure out, okay, if we do this, what's a priority for us? Is it land? Is it portables? Is it a permanent structure? Okay, let's do a readiness study. Let's take 1 month. Let's get consultants in, and we'll try to pull this together. And over 3-4 days, boom, 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 knock this out, get a report back. Okay, let's then figure out, okay, what's the structure going to be? What's our cabinet leadership going to be like? We need at least 6 months to pull that together, likely. And then once you get that, you launch what's called the quiet phase. This is what I would call the pyramid work. You need 12 months, I think, realistically, depending on the size of your school and the size of your pyramid, to strategically cultivate with the right people on your cabinet leadership those potential high-capacity donors. Now, the hope is you're in a school culture where that's been happening already all the time. So you're not just going in fresh for the kill. These people know you. They love your school. They're invested already. You're going after them, building genuine relationship with them over the 6 to 12 months in the quiet phase to share with them the story that is yours to tell in this capital campaign effort so that you get 12 months later to a point where you've got 80%+ of your funds raised and you're ready to go public. You're ready to go into the loud phase. You're ready to close the gap. You break ground, give yourself 12 months, a year pretty quick, for construction and then dedication. That right there is almost 4 years. And that's pretty aggressive in my humble opinion. Okay, well, we spent a lot of time talking about the grammar of a capital campaign and the logic. Now let's spend just a few minutes as I close on the rhetoric of a capital campaign. The good news by this time is that if you've gone through these various steps in laying the foundation for a capital campaign at your classical Christian school, I think you discover already that you have clearly a story to tell. You have a history. You have struggles and challenges. You have failures and victories. You have a clear mission and now a clear vision about your future and your future facilities needs. The rhetoric stage of a capital campaign is not about marketing sophistry Was it Quintilian who said that rhetoric is a good man speaking well? Your institution at this point is hopefully at a place where you're telling a true, honest, informed, exciting story about where you've been, where you are, and where you're going. It's not about putting lipstick on a pig. It's not about trying to sell something to people that don't need it and don't even want it. And it's not about trying to trick them out of their money. It's about prayerfully sharing your school's story in compelling ways that align with the potential donor's particular passions. It's about your case for support. So when it comes to having a capital campaign, it's good to come up with a brand. This was our brand for our last campaign, Building Lifetime Learners. Now, you see anything interesting with this logo and design on the far right? That obviously looks like some trees, a little water, and some buildings. It's a reflection of our academic village type structures. Anybody see anything else? So the student sitting in a chair, right? That's kind of cool. The graphic artist who's a board member came up with that. And we thought that was pretty neat. We went through all sorts of, actually, I don't know if you can remember, but early on, we went through dozens and dozens of themes and ideas and then went through a handful of logos and finally kind of agreed on one. But you need a brand. You need something to kind of be the look, the logo, the theme of your particular effort. This, for us, fit right into the rhetoric of our mission statement. The Covenant School exists to glorify God by equipping students with the tools necessary to be lifetime learners, that they might discern reason, defend truth, and service to our Lord Jesus Christ. So we really pulled that right out of our mission statement, and we want to say, look, we're doing this because our facilities are really ultimately subservient to our mission. They're here to help us carry that out. Even in the quiet phase, as you meet with your top prospects, the brand can be used on collateral materials, brochures, letters, postcards, and maybe even videos if you go that route. We've had kind of mixed success with videos. We did a video this past campaign that was donated by the construction company building our building. Apparently, it's like a $50,000 value, a computer-generated thing. It was pretty neat. Did that result in gifts we wouldn't have otherwise gotten? Don't know. I just don't know. The verdict's still out in my mind. As it is on really expensive, fancy things you publish with slick photos. I would be just very cautious about spending too much money. You need some things, but I'd just be very purposeful. The buy-in. However you do it, pick out a theme that ties with your school's identity and vision and use that to cultivate your donor base with the story and the opportunity. This process is the heart of your school's capital campaign. The process of generating buy-in happens during the quiet phase. It's not done in large groups, but in small, intimate gatherings. You don't raise money in large groups of people with pledge cards on tables. You really don't. You might get some money. You might raise a good chunk of change, and maybe your schools are an exception. But typically, you raise money with cultivated relationships in intimate settings, person to person, one to two, two to three. And let me also just suggest this. Real, substantial buy-in is also not generated by raw emotion and enthusiasm. We have a building that's about to open in a couple of months called the Carson Leslie Center, named in honor of a student who died tragically of brain cancer a couple of years ago. He was actually involved in some of the input in designing the building. It was named in his honor because a donor came forward confidentially to give an anchor gift, and we wanted to, in essence, donate it to him before the ground even broke to build it, and that's what happened. And so it's a very special project for us. And the donor who gave the initial gift, it was very sacrificial in doing so. You would think, let's rally behind this kid in his memory who'd been at the school for 11 years, whose dad was a board member, whose mom taught. And we're going to raise this money. It's going to fall from heaven. We're going to build this thing. We're going to break all the records. We're going to shoot all that stuff about reality and typical experiences in the world of fundraising out the window. It's going to be special. It's going to be different. No. You don't raise money, big money, to build big permanent buildings based on emotion. Even the emotion generated by the tragic loss of one of your own students. At least we didn't. Sufficient buy-in through actual gifts. Oh, let me say this one other thing about emotion. How do you then, raising money, how do you then do it if it's not emotion, tragedy, enthusiasm, energy, big group meetings? How do you do it? Well, if I could put it in one sentence, I'd suggest it's this way. And again, I'm no expert at this, but in the context of patient, persistent prayer, buy-in is the result of a reasonable, informed act of a donor's will, persuaded in his heart and imagination by a compelling investment opportunity in your school. And it's kind of a long run-on sentence, but I'll read it again. In the context of patient, persistent prayer, you also don't raise money, big money, overnight. It takes time to cultivate. You've got to plant the seeds, cultivate that relationship, and like a foundation, donors have to be wooed. You have to earn the right to be heard. And it may take 6 months, 12 months, 2 years, 3 years. They may start out with a $5,000 gift before they give a $50 or $5 million gift. But in the context of patient, persistent prayer, buy-in is the result of a reasonable, informed act of a donor's will, persuaded in his heart and imagination by compelling investment opportunity in your school. The compelling investment opportunity is the fruit of your story, of your case for support. Sufficient buy-in through actual gifts and documented pledges is critical to any successful campaign. I'm of the opinion that a school should have the large bulk, 80% of its stated goal, given or pledged before going public with the final push of a public campaign, before going from the end of your quiet phase to launching your public phase. So if your goal is $5 million, let's say, I would counsel you to have $4 million in gifts and pledges before kicking the public campaign off. As such, you launch the capital campaign publicly on a solid foundation set up for success. Now, this ties right into the buzz. This is where the buzz comes into play. You've patiently prayed, you've planned, you've managed well your quiet phase, you've got 80% of your need in hand or pledged, you've got $1 million left to raise. You can then tap into the broad base of support, those lemonade stand gifts, those cake sales and garage sales, support among your parents, even those on financial aid, your grandparents, your friends, whomever else hasn't yet participated at that point. You can also then look, with the million left to raise, to your foundations, who you've been hopefully wooing and courting for several years prior to that point, to come in on the back end of capital campaigns. Foundations typically don't like to give the seed money. They like to come in on the back. It makes them look good. Well, and the Quill Foundation's given the final $500 million to complete Covenant's capital campaign. Whoa, aren't they great? They like that. So think of it this way. If you've raised $4 million, you've got $1 million left to raise, and it's not necessarily unrealistic to expect 10% of your total goal to come from foundations. If my math there is correct, that's $500,000. And so if you realistically could get $500,000, a $500,000 from foundations, you really only have another $500,000 to get from corporate sources and or other people who have some vested interest in your community. Only $500,000. It's a lot of money. This becomes the sprint to the finish line, helped along with lots of PR, photos, banners, articles, website information, T-shirts, etc. The bottom line. I'm almost done. Once you've planned and prioritized your school's capital needs from property to classrooms, what you've done, the study, structured and strategized, whatever you end up stating is your capital campaign goal, you want to set up your school for success. You want to make a compelling case for support. If you save $5 million and raise $10 million, all the more praise be to God. Stating $10 million as your goal, however, and raising $5 million, well, praise be to God for the five, but it makes you look kind of goofy, doesn't it? It doesn't show necessarily a reflection of coordinated strength and planning on your part as a school. To fall miserably short reveals a lack of foresight and strategic planning on the part of the school and campaign leadership. Yes, God ordains the ends and the means to those ends, but I would suggest that there's no virtue in trying to pervert God's miraculous provision through poor and foolish planning. Conclusion. A time to party. When you've successfully finished your capital campaign at your classical Christian school, you've raised the $5 million. You got to throw a party. From groundbreaking parties to dedication ceremonies, capital campaigns provide unique corporate opportunities for school communities to come together in humble awe of God's gracious abundance for his resources in carrying out the purposes, his purposes, hopefully, for his school. Put on a little cool in the gang and celebrate. And remind yourselves, as is our school verse and motto, remind yourselves, known no beast, not unto us, O Lord, but unto thy name give glory. And also don't forget, relationships, relationships, relationships. Guns don't kill people, people kill people. We've heard that before. In the same way, money doesn't build buildings, people build buildings. When all is said and done, it's about the people. It's about the people that make up your school and mine. It's about your donors. Missions and visions do not live in buildings. They reside in the courageous and sacrificial hearts, minds, and imaginations of our school's steward and servant leaders. And under the lordship of Christ, we should be free to tell our school stories and constantly give people a chance to be blessed by participating in furthering our school stories into the future. It's about cultivating, always and all the time, relationships and extending joy into the lives of those who invest in our schools. This is an ongoing effort, and whether you're in a formal campaign mode or not, we must never forget it. Finally, bricks, mortar, and mission. With success in building out your school's capital, physical campus, the challenge for us will be this: to stand fast in preserving and promoting our school's distinct classical and Christian mission. Man looks on the external appearance, but God looks on the heart. Man is drawn to new buildings, slick gym floors, and turf football fields. To be sure, matter matters, and facilities are essential to our institutional stability and mission success. But if our schools will be around 100 years from now, what will differentiate them will not be our fancy facilities, but our educational visions. It will be a vision that will have since trained up generations of men and women seeking to live faithful lives under the lordship of Christ as citizens of a kingdom built by the price of his shed blood, the kingdom alone, which can neither be purchased nor shaken. Thank you. I think our time is up, but if you have any questions or thoughts, feel free to hang around, and I will do so as well. Thanks for coming out. And if you want to follow up with anything, feel free to shoot me an email. I think it's in your booklet.